All right. Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. And we've got a hell of a show for you today. And I'm going to be pretty damn fast getting it on to you, all right? At the back end of the show, we're going to be talking with Deborah S. Esquenazi and Ana Vasquez, who are two of the people, the filmmaker and one of the characters of the story. It's about a film called Southwest of Salem, the story of the San Antonio Four, four young gay women who were framed for raping and improper sexual contact with children. And it turned out, after doing many, many years in jail, that in fact the entire thing was concocted. All right, so that's at the back end of the show. In the middle of the show, we're going to be talking with Bill Ayers on why radical imaginations of children should be nurtured, not clamped down on and punished for even thinking outside of the box, right? And I'm really looking forward to digging into that with Bill Ayers. Opening the show up, though, I'm very happy to welcome back to the show Jeffrey Haas. Jeffrey is a radical lawyer, and he's the author of The Assassination of Fred Hampton. And he's been on the Standing Rock. He's been up at the Standing Rock protests in North Dakota against the Dakota Access Pipeline, involving thousands of Native Americans and others. And Jeff is a civil rights lawyer who recently volunteered at Standing Rock for quite some time. Jeff, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Yeah, good to hear you again, man. Well, let's jump into this. What are you doing up in Standing Rock, and what's the situation there now?
The situation is that actually almost every day people from the camp, water protectors, are going out to where the pipeline is being constructed and holding a prayer service or standing in the way of the equipment. And hundreds of people are going out, and the response by police is increasing. Now they have armed carriers. They have all kinds of, they're actually having loaded weapons. They arrested 22 people yesterday. And I think the determination of the people at Standing Rock is not to let this pipeline, the Dakota Access Pipeline, go through.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you're ongoing,
I was going to say,
our job as lawyers has been to either monitor the demonstrations, interview people after they're arrested, and try to get them out on bond.
Now, there's a whole team, a whole legal team there, right? The Red Owl Collective. How is that pulled together? And who does it consist of?
Well, it was a lot pulled together by the National Lawyers Guild. And Bruce Ellison, who has been an active lawyer for Native Americans going back to Wounded Knee, started drawing people there, and the Lawyers Guild put out a call from New York, the Mass Defense League. And so I came, and Rachel Lederman, actually from the West Coast, came. And there have just been lawyers from all over, pretty much working pro bono. One of the problems is in North Dakota, you have to be admitted to the bar, actually, to speak in the courtroom. So, and it's a long process to get admitted. So we're also trying to find local lawyers. We do have an indigenous lawyer, Angela Bibbins, who is working with us pretty much on the ground every day. So we're trying to maintain a presence in camp. There are a lot of questions that come up about actions. When is my court day? Do I have to appear? What are the charges? And so forth. So it's sort of handling a lot of the questions on the ground, other issues that come up, and then representing people in court or trying to find lawyers for the people in court.
Now, there's been already, as I understand it, there's been more than 80 arrests up there in North Dakota, right, charging criminal trespass and nonviolent direct actions that included things like lockdowns on earth-moving equipment to prevent the Dakota Access LLC from building the pipeline.
Yeah,
this has to be a pretty grueling thing there, right?
Well, it's amazingly how professionally and nonviolently it's done. They call it nonviolent direct action. It is. And they actually have pipes, and they lock themselves onto the earth-moving equipment. And then they have directions when law enforcement comes, is, well, this is how you can get me off. But it stops the equipment. It does not lead to violence, and they're very committed to nonviolent direct action. But they're very much committed to stopping the construction of the pipeline. So it's quite effective, and I think the response to it is escalating because they don't quite know. Actually, they've had hundreds of people now out there standing in the way of the earth-moving equipment or videoing what's going on, and some people are locking down.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and in your piece, I read where you said that the flags of more than 250 indigenous nations have been present at all this activity, and that they've come on horseback in canoes down the Missouri River and some in buses and caravans from as far away as Alaska. I mean, this is something that when you're talking about that and you're looking at people as dedicated and committed to actually stopping this thing because they recognize what it's going to mean for the earth and what it's going to mean for humanity if this goes through, and then you guys are there as the Red Owl Collective, which actually is a great name. I thought that was a very good name. And you've been doing...
I like it too.
Yeah, and you've been doing interviews, jail interviews with most of those arrested. What have you learned from those interviews?
I think I've learned that there, you know, and it ranges, you know, from people, the elders who are really concerned about the sacred sites and everybody's concerned about the water. There are supporters who are concerned about the climate. But there's just this, we've taken it long enough. We're not going to let them poison our water. And they want to put this pipeline in the Missouri River right above where we take our drinking water. There was an alternate plan that would have had it go through Bismarck, which is almost all white, which the Army Corps of Engineers refused to do and said that would threaten the water there. And so they brought it down right above the Standing Rock Reservation. And I think it was just one more time when the people said, we've had enough. They have this vision that they've had of this black snake coming and threatening their survival. And, of course, the black snake is the oil. It's the oil from the Bakken fields in western North Dakota. This pipeline could carry 500,000 barrels a day, the equivalent of about 15 million cars. So they also understand that the planet is not going to survive the carbon footprint of more transmitting of oil and excavation of oil. And so I think there's a sort of a, this is our sacred land, this is the land that we've, our burial sites are on, this is our water that you're threatening, and this is our air and our planet. And between those three things, and their slogan is water is life, there's a real commitment of these tribes.
Mm-hmm. In the op-ed piece you wrote for Truth Out, you mentioned that on September 22nd, they paid $18 million to purchase the land. It's a site of many of the confrontations, and that bolsters their ability to have protesters arrested for criminal trespass. Has that resulted in a major increase in arrests?
Well, I think what's happened is they originally arrested a lot of people on that site. I think we all saw when Amy Goodman, when the security dogs attacked mm-hmm. the protesters. I was there that day. And that was on one of the right-of-ways or the easement that the pipeline had. So they arrested people for trespass on that day. And I think they realized, well, maybe they don't even own that land. And how can they charge them with trespass? So if they buy the land and they bought it and put up no trespassing signs, but then those were somehow removed during the evening, then they have a better case for trespass because there were no trespassing signs before. Mm-hmm. It is an amazingly extravagant purchase, $18 million for a ranch. And under North Dakota law, a corporation can't run a farm or a ranch. So what are they going to do with that? I think it was just a show of force or show of determination. We'll spend anything. And that's the attitude of the pipeline. They want to make this go. They want to finish this part of it before it gets too cold up there. They've borrowed money from a lot of the major banks, and that they're having to pay interest on that. And one of the issues is putting pressure on Wells Fargo and Bank of America that have loaned money to this pipeline. So both sides are escalating, I think, or at least the defense is determined that this pipeline is not going to be built. And I think the pipeline, the private owners, Energy Transfer Partners and Enbridge, who both have bad records for oil spills, are determined to try to make this go through.
Mm-hmm. And as your piece says, you point out that the resistance continues and there's an increasing mobilization and presence of law enforcement agencies to match that. And it's fairly heavy. And then you get into, you say, currently, right now, because of all the things that you were talking about earlier about what's required of attorneys to practice and to represent people in North Dakota, you then say that actually you need more attorneys and legal workers to come up to Standing Rock. Can you talk about that a minute?
Yeah. I mean, yesterday, Wednesday, there were three actions in different parts of the county along the pipeline. And we didn't have legal workers available to be observers. And then when masses of people got brought into the jail, one of our people had to stay there till 2 o'clock in the morning just interviewing people so that we'd have an argument to make for their bail the next morning. So we do need more lawyers at the camp to answer questions, to do interview people for bond hearings, and to be observers at these actions. Yesterday, they were pointing loaded weapons at the protesters, and anything could spark something that could be much worse. So we think having a legal presence at some of these actions might prevent something that could, some overreaction by this military force that's been gathered. So we definitely want more lawyers up there.
All right. More lawyers up in North Dakota. That's going to, yes, let's get that going.
The other thing is, yeah, and people can, there have been protests nationally against the banks that have loan the money, I think, in many cities. And Standing Rock people want people's support, and they also want their struggle to lend support for struggles around water and around preventing the mass carbonation of the atmosphere. So we want our struggle to add to others, and we want support of other people as well.
Mm-hmm. All right, one final question. What actually, if people want to be, if there's lawyers out there, law students, people who work in law offices, if they want to come and join with you guys in what you're doing, how do they get in touch with people?
One of the people I think they could, Robin Martinez at martinezlaw.org or .com, I'm trying to remember. The National Lawyers Guild Mass Defense Office, King Downing, is a good way to do it. So I think either one of those, or if they, people wanted to contact me, jeffreyhaas42@gmail.com, and tell me when they want to come, we're arranging a schedule. Robin Martinez is robin.martinez@martinezlaw.net, and he's sort of coordinating that effort, and he's out of Denver.
Okay. All right, Jeff, keep in touch with this man and let us know as things develop, okay?
I certainly will. Thank you, and thank you for keeping your listeners informed about Standing Rock. It is a volatile, ongoing situation, and even though the government issued the, withdrew the permit for them drilling under the Missouri, that has really not stopped the drilling and not stopped the resistance.
Mm-hmm. All right, Jeffrey, thank you very much, man.
Thank you.
All right, take care now. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Jeffrey Haas, an attorney who's up at Standing Rock in North Dakota and defending people and being basically the legal army posed against the all the fascists that want to, you know, drill for oil and drill for all this stuff and just basically end the life of the planet. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back talking with Bill Ayers about why the radical imaginations of children should be nurtured, not destroyed. All right, so stay tuned for that.
They make you feel small by giving you no time instead of it all. Till the pain is so big you feel nothing at all. A working class hero is something to be. Working class hero is something to be.
All right, welcome back. That was John Lennon with Working Class Hero. And if you play that song all the way out, I think it speaks a lot to what we're about to talk to today, what we're about to talk about right now. Bill Ayers is a distinguished professor of education and a senior university scholar at the University of Illinois at Chicago. He's retired, and he's a founder of both the Small Schools Workshop and the Center for Youth and Society. And he's a hell of a presence in the world today, one that we need to hear a whole lot more from. Bill, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
Sure. I got a whole stack of questions for you, okay? So we're just going to run through this, man.
Okay.
Good article, by the way. It was a very good article. The Radical Imagination of Our Children Should Be Nurtured. That's the title of the article. And people can find that. It's actually part of a book that you just – is the book published now?
The book is out. Actually, the launch of the book is tonight in Chicago. But it's been out for a couple of weeks. And it's called The Man, The Impossible, Radical Manifesto. And Haymarket Books brought it out. So, yeah. It's available, and it's very exciting for me right now.
Yeah, and I like the title. It's a hell of a title, Demand the Impossible. That's good. your piece is titled, The Radical Imagination of Our Children Should Be Nurtured, a radically different starting place from not only the position of the systems educators, but even from many who are really saying that they're attempting to give children a decent education. What's the difference in approach you have, and why?
Well, I start from a couple of places. One is that I've been an educator all my life, starting when I was 20 years old. I'm now 72, and I started in the Freedom Schools and in the tradition of thinking of education as linked to social justice, to social change, and that's kind of been my guiding principle all along. I really believe that in a democracy, education is based on a fragile but precious ideal. And that is that every human being is of incalculable value. And if you start from that point, you realize that the fullest development of all of us is the condition for the full development of any of us. And that kind of sets out some parameters, not only for policy, but for curriculum and teaching. And in a free society, what you'd want to do is foreground not obedience and conformity, which is the hallmark of every autocratic or authoritarian regime in the world. You'd want to foreground the arts of liberty, which are imagination, creativity, dialogue, entrepreneurship, initiative, agency, and so on. And so that's what I have written about for many, many years when it comes to schools and school reform.
Mm-hmm. Now, in this piece, you cite the Freedom Schools, and you just mentioned them, and you talk about Charlie Cobb and the whole idea behind the Freedom Schools that were started by the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, SNCC, in Mississippi in the early 60s. You cite that as an inspirational and even functional model. Why and how?
Well, to me, I was, again, very fortunate to start in that tradition, but and it's guided me ever since. But what Charlie Cobb said in 1963 was the black people of Mississippi have been denied many things: decent schools, decent facilities, forward-looking curriculum, fully trained teachers. But the fundamental injury is they've been denied to think for themselves about the circumstances of their lives, how they got here, and how they could be different. Now, if you think about that, that's a revolutionary comment in Mississippi in 1963. In fact, the three martyrs of Mississippi in 1963 were murdered after investigating the arson burning of a Freedom School. Two of them were Freedom School teachers. So that was an incendiary idea that you have the right to ask, who am I? How did I get here? Where do I want to go? And that led to a brilliant curriculum called the Mississippi Freedom School Curriculum, which you can find online. But taking that up to the present, those questions are as relevant today as they were when Charlie Cobb uttered them. That is, the children of the South Bronx, the children of the West Side of Chicago, the children of South Central L.A. have been denied many things: decent facilities, fully trained teachers, you know, outstanding curriculum, forward-looking curriculum. But the fundamental injury is nobody is asking them to use their own agency, their own imaginations, to inquire into how we got into the situation we're in and where we'd like to go. That's a Freedom School curriculum in a nutshell.
Well, one of the things that you say, and it's interesting to me, because you really put a lot of emphasis on the radical imagination of children and how that has to be unleashed, how it has to be actually further developed. Let's talk about that, because it's, you know, you're talking about schools. And frankly, I mean, look, anybody who's ever had any experience with the public school systems or with parochial schools or whatever, you basically, it is like that sort of, you feel like Pink Floyd's another brick in the wall thing, right? You're sort of like, what the hell is going on? You know, people are taught not to break the standard. People are taught not to think, but to follow instructions. And you really put a lot of emphasis on the importance. And you seem to be saying the same thing was true in relation to the Freedom Schools in terms of what you got out of it and what you saw it bringing to other people was really a lot of release of imagination that was really critical to people, to the whole idea of educating people for a society that would be worth living in.
A society that would be worth living in, a society that was free. What was impossible in 1958 or 1950 was the idea that we could get rid of Jim Crow. People began to demand the impossible, and the Freedom Schools actually played a very important role in 1963-64 at a time when the Civil Rights Movement was in a lull. And in an attempt to re-energize it, SNCC came up with this idea that we should gather in parks and in public spaces and in church basements, and we should ask people to ask their own questions, to interrogate the universe. And that's how we get smart. It's not by going along with what is. And I said earlier, you know, that obedience and conformity is the hallmark of every authoritarian regime. And that's what, you know, since schools reflect, are both mirror and window into a society, you would expect authoritarian regimes to emphasize obedience and conformity. But in a free society, we have to go somewhere else. And the radical imagination is actually ordinary for kids. It's something that comes to them. That is, they ask questions like, is it fair? You know, three-year-olds ask, that's not fair. And what would be fair? And it seems to me that those kinds of questions, rather than, you know, being suppressed or deflected, are the very questions that could power a curriculum, whether it's in preschool or graduate school. People interrogating the universe for themselves. You know, I was thinking of questions the other day. I was thinking of, I don't know, if I'm sure you watched the debate. Mm-hmm. I watched it in Washington, D.C. at Busboys and Poets with 500 other people. But I kept thinking about the questions that weren't stretching our imaginations. The questions were all conventional. They were all entertainment. But nobody was asking, you know, would you pardon Edward Snowden? Would you give him the Presidential Medal of Freedom? You know, do you think education is a human right, or do you think it's a product to be sold at the marketplace? Those are the kind of questions that we should be asking our politicians. Those are the kind of questions we should be asking ourselves.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Bill Ayers. Bill, we're talking with Bill's piece that appeared in Truth Out called The Radical Imagination of Our Children Should Be Nurtured. Now, Bill, one of the things that actually, as I'm looking at some of my notes on this, you know, you make a point again about this thing about the radical imaginations. You say that they're tenacious, that they doggedly refuse to go quietly into that dark, dark night, which I love that description, okay? But let's talk about that a little, because that's extremely important, because, you know, look, again and again, and I went to Catholic school. I know where, you know, where you're sort of, you can imagine the horrors of that, where you're like, everything is just beaten into you, you know? And they don't even, you know, everything, any sense of creativity is beaten into you. You're taught to follow the rules and, you know, God help you if you don't. And that's their words, not mine, okay?
Right.
But basically, you know, you actually really argue for this thing of that our radical imaginations are tenacious and they doggedly refuse to go quietly into that dark, dark night. And that, to me, it seems like what you're saying, you're putting a lot of emphasis on that as a defining quality of a place you'd want to live.
Well, it is. And not only is it a defining quality of where I'd want to live, as I said earlier, to me, imagination is a cornerstone of the arts of liberty. And, you know, it's something that it requires us to move beyond the conventional and thinking of morality as convention. Most of us, most of the time, act like Americans. Most Athenians act like Athenians. Most Spartans act like Spartans. That means we have some responsibility to think beyond personal virtue and ask ourselves, what is society providing us in terms of a groundwork for acting ethically by acting normally? In other words, during the days of slavery, could you be a slave owner who pays your bills on time, is kind to your children, never cheats or lies or steals in business, and at the same time holding other people in bondage, raping other people, destroying their lives? Could you be called an ethical person? Is that a moral grounding? So the social imagination, the radical social imagination, is an imagination that asks, what kind of society do we live in? Not, am I going along and am I okay person given what's given to me, but what would make the world better for more of us? That's the radical social imagination. And I think on the other side, a good definition of a bigot is somebody whose imagination is constrained, controlled, or destroyed, and they can't imagine what the world looks like to another person. It's all filtered through a narcissism that's destructive to them and to the world.
Mm-hmm. Now, I want to ask you this because it follows right along with that. You say that if all this happened, if really there was a recognition and the nurturing of our radical imaginations, you pose a question for people to think about. What would happen if this actually, what would happen in the world if this actually was going on? And you say, you answer it with, we know today that the world would crack open. Let's talk about that a little.
Well, the world as it is would crack open in the sense that everything we take as normal could be upended. Not everything, but the fundamental injustices. You know, one of the rhythms to me of activism is you have to open your eyes and pay attention. You have to be astonished both at the beauty and the ecstasy you see in all directions, but also astonished at the unnecessary suffering and the kind of predicament that we visit upon one another. And then you have to act. So to me, opening your eyes is the beginning of having a radical imagination, but not the end. I'm old enough to have lived through a moment when history and hope rhymed, and that was the great civil rights rising. And what was unimaginable just a short time before Rosa Parks sat in, what was just unimaginable and impossible the day after she sat in became inevitable, and that's the nature of all revolutions. And so the Civil Rights Revolution, you could call it the Third American Revolution. We're now kind of entering a fourth uprising in the centuries-old struggle for black freedom. But that was impossible before it happened. And once it happened, it not only did it seem inevitable, but it brought many of us into the vortex of struggle, and we built a new world. The same is true of slavery. You know, and I think it's important to remember that Lyndon Johnson wasn't part of the black freedom movement, but he passed the most far-reaching civil rights legislation since Reconstruction because of fire from below. The same is true of Abraham Lincoln. He never belonged to an abolitionist party, but when fire from below pushed him, he became an abolitionist in the midst of, you know, his first term. That was another world becoming possible. That was the world cracking open.
Mm-hmm. We're going to end with this. There's two things I wanted to talk about. I'm going to try and combine them into one. So we'll see if you can. It might turn out to be a giant mountain there. But you say that when the aim of education is the reproduction of all the social relations as they are now, schooling is nothing more than locating oneself on the grand pyramid of winners and losers. And then you also make this point that free teachers and free students refuse obedience and conformity in favor of liberating dispositions of the mind. Let's talk about those two.
Okay, well, I mean, I think you can see quite clearly that our educational system is not based. It must be based, but it's not based on the idea that every human being is of incalculable value. It's a giant sorting machine, and at the end of the day, people are left to feel that they earned their position in the society. It's far from true, but it's the way people feel. So I look right now at our recently retired Secretary of Education, Arne Duncan. He was the head of the Chicago schools for 7 years. He was the head of the nation's schools for 7 years. And when he returned to Chicago, he couldn't find a single school to put his own children in. So he put his children in a private school. And in that private school, they have a class size limited to 15. They take a third of the tests that the Chicago public school kids take. So they're not obsessed with drilling and skilling. They have a full arts program, including orchestra and theater and fine arts. They have a full sports program and so on. And they have a curriculum based in part on asking questions and pursuing answers of your own interest. Now, if that's good enough for the head of the educational system in this country, why is that not good enough for the rest of us? Why isn't that good enough for the kids on the West Side? Some people will say, well, we can't afford it. Well, I'm sorry, but if we agree that it's a goal, we will find a way to afford it. My grandkids have gone to public school here in Chicago, and not only did they cut the arts programs and then cut the music programs and then cut after school, my granddaughters had to bring their own toilet paper to school in the richest country, one of the richest cities in the richest country in the world. That's an obscenity, and that's a signal to kids that you don't matter. We don't value you. We need to change that.
Mm-hmm. Now, Bill, what's the name of your book?
The book is called Demand the Impossible, A Radical Manifesto. We're in the 15th anniversary of the publisher Haymarket here in Chicago, a wonderful publishing house. And I urge folks to get it and be in dialogue.
All right, Bill, I want to thank you very much for joining us today. And we'll stay in touch, man. I'll follow what you're writing and get you back again, all right?
Thanks so much, Mike.
All right, take care now.
Bye-bye.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Bill Ayers. Bill is a distinguished professor of education and a senior university scholar at the University of Illinois at Chicago. He's retired, and he's a founder of both the Small Schools Workshop and the Center for Youth and Society. And his piece, which is called The Radical Imagination of Our Children Should Be Nurtured, all right? And you can find that on Truth Out. It's really a piece worth reading. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back, so stay tuned. Welcome back. Now, I know all of you people who are about the same age as me, we'll just describe that as still very young, who are about the same age as me are out there singing that song right now, singing along with it, all right? Now, you're not fooling nobody. Look around you. Look at the cars in the other lanes, and you're going to find people singing that song. It's just that good, okay? The song is Be My Baby from Sandy Posey, and it's a great song. I really love it, and I was really, really pleased to be playing it today. All right, we're going to be quick and jump into this one because I want to be able to actually people to get a real chance to listen to this hard, all right? Deborah S. Esquenazi is the director of Southwest of Salem, The Story of the San Antonio Four, and Ana Vasquez is one of the San Antonio Four. The San Antonio Four were four Latina lesbians who were persecuted and prosecuted and wrongfully sentenced to long prison sentences for the gang rape of children in Texas in the 1990s. And it's not a film to be missed, folks. It's an extremely important film. We recently had a chance to talk with Deborah and Ana, and I want to bring that to you now, so check this out. I recently heard about a film that I was really encouraged to see, and people were really arguing for it just very, very deeply. I mean, you could see it was one of those films that had really touched people. It's called Southwest of Salem, The Story of the San Antonio Four. In 1997, 1998, three young Latina lesbians from San Antonio, Texas, were wrongfully convicted and sentenced to 15 years in prison, along with a fourth innocent gay woman, the alleged ringleader, who received 37.5 years behind bars. All were alleged to have gang raped two sisters, the nieces of the so-called ringleader, two little girls ages 7 and 9. There was no hard conventional evidence against the four women, but an investigator speculated they were involved in satanic-related sexual abuse, and it went on from there. And I'm really pleased to be joined today by the director of the film, Deborah Eskenazi, and by one of the four women that went to jail on those trumped-up charges, and her name is Ana Vasquez. Ana, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And Deborah, thank you very much for the film, and thanks for coming to the show, too.
Thank you. It's an honor.
Deborah, I want to know what made you feel compelled to do this film, because as you read the story and you watch the film, you can understand some things, but you were actually brought into it, not knowing much about it, and you felt really compelled to make this film.
I did, yeah. So my mentor, Debbie Nathan, who wrote a pivotal book about the satanic sexual abuse panic or hysteria of the 80s and 90s, brought this case to me. And she sent me the discovery materials, which is the trial transcripts and the police reports and the medical reports. And so she suggested I take a look at it because I had moved from New York to Texas. You know, initially, it was an overwhelming case. I mean, it was really big. The women had already been in prison for 10 years. So I was incredibly nervous to take it on. The first thing I did is I sat and read Elizabeth Ramirez's trial transcripts. She's the one who received 37 and a half years. And as you read it, you begin to see a sort of fundamental systemic homophobia that is just really pulling this case forward. Not to mention all the mentions of these were lesbians and the sort of gang rape and cult type activities. And these were certain perversions that, you know, over the course of 2 days that they were allegedly raping these two kids. It was so astonishing, and it felt false. It read false. So that's sort of how I began.
Ana, why don't you tell us what actually happened?
So the four of us are childhood friends. Some of us went to school together, like Liz and I. We played sports together. We were in high school together. And maybe 2 years after that, I met Cassie and Christy. We were all friends, you know, and we still are to this day. And we have an unbelievable bond between us that nothing can ever come between us. So we're just friends trying to live life, make a life for ourselves because we were young adults. I was 19, and we were accused of aggravated sexual assault on Liz's two nieces. They were 7 and 9 at the time.
It's very heavy because when you look at the film, when you see the pictures of you going to the beach and just the playing around and the kidding around with, I guess, Cassie. Okay.
Yeah, Cassie and I were partners and raising her two children.
Mm-hmm. You were just having fun, you know, and you looked at every aspect of your life that you presented in the film, Deborah. It was like, it was very heavy because you're watching it and you're thinking, these people went to jail for such a long period of time. And one person, Elizabeth went for, she was sentenced to 37 and a half years.
Yes, that's correct.
And you guys were sentenced to what, 15 years?
15 years.
Yeah, yeah. And you did quite a number of those years.
Yes. Right?
And when you look at that, you're sitting there and you're thinking, how did they possibly contrive this assault against you? The story they told was so far removed from the pictures that you showed, from the life that you showed.
Exactly. And because of that, and because of the way that we are portrayed in the film, I mean, the private movie footage, the part about the beach and the part where we're in my home, and we were just ordinary young adults trying to survive in this brutal world. The thing is that, you know, you asked why or how this had gone this far. Well, back in the early 90s, you know, they associated gay people with harming children. That was something that I had never known about until later on in life. It's almost like a perversion the way they looked at us back then. And it's very sad that back then it was almost like we were held in trial by public opinion. The media was not on our side at all. So going into the film, and it took a lot of time to trust Debbie to make this film, but she did an excellent job. We had a conversation while I was still in prison. It was the first time, and we got into an in-depth conversation about her life and her struggles. And I think that that's where it made me realize that she's got a lot of compassion behind this. She knows the struggles that I once faced, and now she was dealing with it at the same time. So I just felt like a connection to her, almost like a sisterhood.
Mm-hmm. I think she means about my coming out.
I was just going to say that because I read something in a statement that you made that was very moving, because you said, look, I not only felt compelled to make this film, but I had to make this film. Let's talk about that.
You know, I came out to the women in prison before I came out to my own family. And I don't want to make it about me either, because really this is the story of these four women and their bravery. But it felt false to tell their tale while they're sitting there suffering and languishing in prison for as long as they did, trying to fight for their freedom because they're gay, because they were out, right? And then here I am in the closet, and it felt false to me. So through sort of the relationship of watching their bravery, I felt compelled to come out. And years later, looking back, that was a critical moment for me. I mean, I grew up in Texas. I grew up in the suburbs of Texas. I still live in Texas. It's just a different place to be gay. And I remember the Satanic Panic really well, because that was in my backyard and living in the Houston suburb. So when it came into their story came into my lap, it was so familiar. It was like, I remember this. Just the feeling or the fear of part of coming out was the fear that people would think that gay people have a predilection to harming children. That is actually in the Latino community especially. I feel like that's a conversation I'm having a lot. And, you know, I don't want to perpetuate some myth that Latino communities are more homophobic than others. That's not true.
Well, it's the way that the society portrays it all along and has continued to portray it. Even today, with everything they say, oh, well, you know, gay people have made so many advances. Still, I'll tell you what, there's still a whole lot of bozos out there that have a certain type of thinking. And frankly, the system, the way it treats gay people. This is not something that is warmly embraced. The fact that you felt like you had to make this film actually gave an opening to you guys in terms of somebody who's actually going to be in your side and digging into this and presenting things and having access to things. When did you make those films where you were actually out looking for the evidence that would show that this was all just total bull?
Yeah, it was like right before we were going to turn ourselves in. July 12th was the day that we actually turned ourselves in. You know, we really believed in the justice system, and it failed us. Raised to obey your elders, trust law enforcement. Personally, I actually trusted the attorneys that I had with my life, and it really didn't just work out that way. I felt like now, knowing what I know now, I feel like I should have been made more aware of things, maybe had more conversations with my attorneys, possibly the ability to gain an expert witness on our behalf, because all they kept saying was, it is the prosecution's job to prove our guilt, not my job to prove your innocence. And that is completely false.
Let's talk a little bit about the prosecution, because I think for both of you, I mean, it's actually, it must have been an eye-opener in terms of you seeing this, but also living through it. It wasn't just the idea of, you know, well, these kids were abused, but there was a whole point about, one, that gay people had a predilection to abusing children. And at the same time, there were all kinds of things that developed around this that were sort of just abhorrent. For instance, even the jury and the guy that was the head of the jury, you know, was a homophobe and a Christian one who was like ready to see. Talk about satanic stuff going on. That's their whole idea. You know, gay people represent an assault on their God, you know.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that, you know, like you said, he was first homophobic, then he was a Christian, that it was like he got excited almost that it was, you know, satanic, and then there's lesbianism in it. And I feel like had Liz had a more experienced attorney, and not a civil one, but one that actually had experience in a case such as this, that he would have striked that juror from even being considered.
It is really extraordinary. I was reading the voir dire from Liz's trial. What you see as you read it is Liz, like I said, received 37 and a half years. And you see there are several members of the jury, and we go into this a little bit in the film, say, actually admit that they were homophobic and were still allowed on the jury. One in particular was this other juror came forward and said, I am a therapist and I am a gay man, and the court is not asking the jury, could they separate the notion that if you are gay, that you have a predilection to harming children? And he was released by the court. So there was actually in the jury, and I forgot about that, but that's not in the film, but I just said after years of working on the film, but it was really like remarkable to see his kind of prescient moment, even in voir dire. And so the court releases him and decides that he can't fit the juror. But I would say in looking at Liz's trial, that there were 4 or 5 members of the jury who did admit that they had discomfort. And that is a lot. We think of a jury made up of 12 members of our peers, and if 3 to 5 of those admit that they are uncomfortable and your life is on the line and you are facing a life sentence, you know, especially in the 90s, especially in San Antonio, the systemic homophobia was so severe that the court allowed them to stay. You know, I mean, I wonder if we could ask that question about race or, you know, in another sense, like, or gender. Are you misogynistic? And if 5 people said, yeah, well, could you at least decide to put your misogyny away in order to be a fair juror? I don't know that a court would allow that. In this case, though, it was permissible to let them stay.
Mm-hmm. This is The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. And I'm talking today with Deborah Esquenazi and Ana Vasquez from the film Southwest of Salem, the story of the San Antonio Four. Deborah is the director of the new documentary, and Anna is one of the San Antonio Four, 4 young Latina lesbians who were prosecuted on false charges of child abuse in the 1990s and ended up doing long years in prison in one of the worst injustices against LGBT people and really anyone in recent history. And if you want to see this film yourself, you can find screenings on the website. Go to southwestofsalem.com.
Well, you know, it's heavy because the misogyny and the homophobia come so closely together in this case, in particular with the guy who was actually their chief witness, the one who brought the case to the courts and was just like looking out for his little girl, you know, and the prosecutor's homophobia, where he kept talking about, and he ended up with he accused you guys of giving a sacrificial lamb to your friends, that Elizabeth was giving a sacrificial lamb to you guys.
Yes.
You know, and that to me, when you think that was the tenor in the courtroom, but it had to be hell to live through, man. I wanted to ask you something, Deborah. I wanted to ask you this because there's a couple of things that stand out. One is your friend that you mentioned, Debbie Nathan. Both of you talked about the satanic thing going on, but what was it that made Debbie Nathan come to you, Deborah, and say, you've got to see this?
It's funny. It'd be really interesting to have her sit here and sort of answer that. I think she was desperate to find anybody because she was an advocate for the National Center for Reason and Justice and was looking for anybody who would actually join from the media side, would join the campaign to report on the women. There was an exceptional article that came out first in San Antonio Express News by a wonderful reporter named Michelle Mondo, who is in the film. And she sort of talks about the court case as a kind of porno film, that there the essence of misogyny was so intense that it felt almost as if a man was fantasizing through it, which is incredibly profound to think about, you know, in terms of these cases. But I think she was looking for anybody. Debbie Nathan was looking for anybody who would report on it. And so why me? I think she knew as my mentor that I was struggling with my own coming out. Mm-hmm. And so she did say to me when I was deciding, she said, this is really important for you to think about doing.
Let's talk about some of the witnesses they have. The person that was supposedly the official medical witness, the doctor who stood up and gave this whole sense of like, this is why they could do it. And basically that argument that they were presenting was later revealed to be, this is sort of junk science. Let's talk about that a little bit, because you're sitting there listening to this and you're listening to them define everything about you folks, that you're somehow driven to come near little kids. And you know, this is like little girls are in danger. If you're in the same house with them, they're in danger. At every corner, you were told that you were sort of Satan's sidekick.
Yes, I agree with that, being Satan's sidekick. You know, I never really knew how she could come up with that conclusion, where she included that in her notes, where it was possibly satanic related. But it was very upsetting. Just because I'm gay and I love my partner, it does not mean that I am perverted in any way, or people have to hold their children back from me being around them. It was really upsetting that she could even say that. And then, you know, we had said all along that it was not true. So when this medical expert, you know, says that there was signs of it in our court case, you know, it was upsetting because I was just like, how? It wasn't, you know, it didn't happen. It never happened. And then when it was debunked, then I was like, I told you all along.
But it was debunked a very long time later.
Yes.
You know, which was, and after you spent more than a decade in prison.
Yes.
You know, one of the things I was thinking about, even as you said this, it's like, even as you're talking about this, you know, and you're talking about the way that they were doing this, you know, you have this, basically this misogynistic macho guy that sort of is a shadow behind a lot of stuff, you know, and I won't say whatever he is or isn't, but he's sort of very clearly had less than friendly opinions about you four.
Mm-hmm.
And yet nothing was ever questioned about him. Nothing was ever, he was allowed to go on. So you want to talk about the kind of, how this plays out in a continual way, you know, through the whole thing, through the whole process. That must have been irritating and angry as hell. For that
very
one.
Much.
Yeah, yeah.
Very much so. Very much.
You also, people should know that you refused to take a plea deal. You know, let's talk about that a little.
Well, after Liz's conviction of 37 and a half years, they had come down to our attorneys and asked if we would consider a plea bargain. And that was something that we never considered. We knew the odds were against us. Our attorneys had informed us that we would lose. We would lose because people are afraid to go against what a child says, with the off chance that it might be true. And nobody wants to do that. Nobody wants to take that chance. But he said that he would fight for me. And I went with that. And that was basically all I had. You know, and that was something that there isn't anybody that could take that away from me. You know I went to prison and it was hard. But I wouldn't be able to live with myself had I taken that plea bargain.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, you wrote endless letters to people.
Yes.
You know, saying, look, this is what's happening to us. Did you ever hear from anybody off of that?
No. And, you know, years later, after myself and the girls finally got together, it was great to hear that everybody was trying to write.
Mm-hmm.
We wrote everybody. I mean, personally speaking, I wrote to Oprah. I wrote everybody that, anybody that had a show that was even somewhat near to what we were going through, I wrote them.
Mm-hmm.
Never heard anything back. You know, and some of the organizations that we went to, even the Innocence Project of Texas, Innocence Network, they said that they couldn't help us because we had no new evidence to present.
And then there's a guy that comes into the picture named Darryl Otto. Darryl Otto. Here's a guy who's sitting in the woods in the wilds of Canada, and he finds your case, and he's like, this is wrong. Nobody was going to stop him. He went from way up in Canada to way down in Texas and said, I'm here to do something.
He's by himself. That's all he does. So for him to come out and actually research our case and come to the conclusion that we are sitting in prison innocently, he felt compelled to reach out to Debbie Nathan, which is the National Center for Reason and Justice. And he pushed for our case to be heard, for her to take a look, because he knew that once she took a look at that, she would be convinced as well. And he did. He pushed for us, and he went through. We came across a lot of people over the years that said, I want to help. I'll do this. I'll do that. And after a couple months, they'd fall off. I don't think anybody really knew how to go about helping us. So for him to actually research our case, stay in communication with us, and for him to reach out to the National Center for Reason and Justice, it's unbelievable.
And drive, by the way, from Canada to Texas.
Yes.
Every year to visit them.
People, when they watched your trial, all they knew was what was being presented.
Mm-hmm.
And in particular, when you're talking about people who are despised because they go against the Christian morals, the Christian morality, and the way the country is set up, and also in particular because of the misogyny and the fact that the assault on manliness in terms of what's the role of men in society, and it's certainly not to tolerate gay people, mm-hmm. you know, men or women. So.
Yes.
You hadn't seen, and you were talking about your partner, Cassie, but you hadn't seen each other for quite some time. And
correct.
Was it that you got transferred to another prison and you ran into, or did she
no,
get transferred?
She did.
She got
she
transferred.
Did. When we got separated because in Texas, the way that it works for the Texas Department of Criminal Justice is that they separate any kind of co-defendants. So they kept us apart. You know, I was in Marlin, Texas, and she was in Gatesville, Texas. So I hadn't seen her, but it just so happened that she had gotten transferred. And this was maybe 11 and a half years into my sentence that she finally came to the unit that I was at, and I saw her, you know, and, oh, my God, you know, of course, you can't just, you know, go up to people and hug them or anything like that, so it was very hard. But I actually had asked my boss to come up with some kind of work order that we had, because I worked maintenance, to go and see her in her dorm. And he did that. You know, I went into her room, them thinking that I'm fixing a light in there, but, you know, we just hugged each other for what seemed like forever.
Yeah, I keep going back to this point about you not taking this plea bargain and what it meant in your life. And, you know, one of the things I thought that was actually really important, too, is the other unexpected development, which was the young woman, one of the so-called victims. In a certain sense, they were victims because they were kids, they were children. And with a screwed-up life, facing this misogynistic ass that's there, that's ruling over their house, and they present this story. And at a certain point, she knows the damage that she did, but she had to say something. And you, Deborah, because you recorded an interview with her in the back of your car, right?
For 2 or 3 years, there had been whispers that she was going to recant, but she never did. And finally, I get a call on a Sunday. Innocence Project of Texas, Mike Ware, lead lawyer, calls me and says, she's going to recant, get to Houston. And she did. She recanted. We spent 3 hours together. The Innocence Project interviewed her at length. And then we got into the back of my Subaru, and I filmed like another interview with her where she actually reads a literal letter, a literal recantation letter. And she reveals in the process what the truth was and why it took her so many years to come forward. And she was agonized by it. It haunted her. It haunted her for years. Mm-hmm. So her coming forward was an extraordinary act of bravery that, you know, I commend incredibly, because at her peril, in a way, because she, you know, as you later see in the film, there are people who then go after her.
And Anna, one thing I'd ask you a little bit more is that you know, what was your feeling when you heard that she recanted?
I was grateful. Mm-hmm. I was grateful and, you know, thinking that here she is taking a chance and finally getting it off her shoulders. And she stood up and she took that. So I too commend her.
So you got out of jail and you got on parole. And it's been a hell of a time too for you on parole, right?
Yes, 2 years.
And you also had to register as a sex offender.
That's correct.
Is that still the case? Were you able to get off of that?
No, actually it took a year after the girls were released in 2013. And Mike, the lawyer for the Innocence Project mm-hmm. of Texas, mm-hmm. he fought diligently to get me off of that list. And unfortunately, trying to get me off that list was near impossible. Nobody knew how to do that. So it actually took him an extra year to get me off of that.
Now, I have one last question that I'll ask both of you. A real sort of backbone to this society, something we've been talking about all through this interview, is the oppression of women. And it shows itself in 1,000 different ways, a million different ways every day. And I'd like to talk to you a little bit about that.
Yeah, I appreciate you saying that, because I think that homophobia is a form of misogyny. Homophobia, to me, is a fundamental disgust of women who aren't straight enough, who aren't feminine enough, or men who are too effeminate. So there's a reason we call it Southwest of Salem. And we do want to be referencing the Salem witch trials, because this was a witch hunt. So much of what you see in this case, we could hearken back to that case, the Salem witch trials, which was about the fear of the other and of sexuality and of the body. And so much to me of also Elizabeth's trial in particular was about body politics. It was about her, how she looked. She's bisexual. I mean, there was so much of it was wrapped in that misogyny and that sexuality.
Would you like to add anything, Anna?
No, I would just like to add the fact that, you know, there is so many different people that this can hit home for. It is not just about gay women. It is not just about our fight for exoneration. You know, there's heterosexuals that are accused of a sexual assault. People can gain strength and resilience from this. I don't know. I would just love for everybody to come out and see the film. And
the film is Southwest of Salem, the story of the San Antonio Four. And we've been talking with the director of the film, Deborah Askenazi, and one of the San Antonio Four, Anna Vasquez. And I want to thank both of you for being with us today.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right. Welcome back. That was the
director and one of the people featured in the film Southwest of Salem, The True Story of the San Antonio Four. I'm telling you, folks, it's a very powerful film. It's a very, very deep understanding. It's what they say in the kicker for it, in the dad for it. They say, do you trust the justice system to find the truth? Well, when you hear this story, you really get a deeper understanding of just what the justice system is all about, the injustice that it's all about. All right. We're going to, you know, right now I want to thank everybody who's been on the show today. Jeffrey Haas from Standing Rock, from the Standing Rock protests in North Dakota. I want to thank Bill Ayers talking about why the radical imaginations of children should be nurtured and not squashed. And I also want to thank Deborah Esquenazi and Ana Vasquez from Southwest of Salem, The Story of the San Antonio Four. And just before we go, there is a path-breaking new book out by Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party. The book is called The New Communism, The Science, The Strategy, The Leadership for an Actual Revolution and a Radically New Society on the Road to Real Emancipation. And this Saturday in New York City, there's going to be a program celebrating Bob Avakian's new book. And it'll be commentary and discussion from Cornel West and Carl Dix. And the program will be moderated by Andy Z of Revolution Books. The New Communism is a book for anyone who cares about the state of the world and the condition of humanity and agonizes over whether fundamental change is really possible. For more information on the book, go to revcom.us or the Bob Avakian Institute. Once again, revcom.us or the Bob Avakian Institute. You definitely want to check this book out, folks. All right, so I want to thank everybody who worked on the show today. I want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, my board off for today, Teddy Robinson, who's sitting over there and pretending he doesn't hear his name being said. Right? There he is. Okay, he's getting all bashful and shy now. Yeah. All right, and I want to thank each and every one of you for listening. And if you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. We're going to go out now with Ain't No Stopping Us Now. So check this out, McFadden and Whitehead.
Us down, but now it looks like things are finally coming around. I know we've got a long, long way to go, and where we'll end up, I don't know. But we won't let nothing hold us back. We're putting our show together, we're polishing up our act. And if you've ever been held down before, I know.